Welcome to the second hour of the Tom Dupree Show. Joining us, Adarsh Meshru, Philip Sexton, Mike Johnson, our host Tom Dupree, with the conversation starter today being what's not to like about a fund with a 7% yield. Here you go, Tom.
So this song is from Mark O'Connor, who's probably one of the more talented musicians in Nashville or even in the country. And he's had a variety of musical styles. He plays the fiddle, but he plays a lot of other stuff. This is an album that he did probably 25 years ago, and called Stone From Which the Arch Is Made. Mark O'Connor, I've seen him live with Victor Wooten, who is, I went to see him with my friend Dan Clifton, and we drove down to Nashville to watch Mark O'Connor and Victor Wooten play, and it was without a doubt one of the best, most active concerts I've ever seen. So anyway, what's not to like about a fund with a 7% yield? A booming stock market isn't what most conservative investors think of as a source of income. That's because interest rates are like negligible these days. But this is Jason Zweig, who's, I will give it to him, he does tend to think a little bit outside the box. But I think I've seen this before. So you got something with a outsized yield in a low interest rate environment. So somewhere in there, there's some leverage taking place where they're borrowing money at a very low rate of interest and they're paying out quite a bit. How do you spell recipe for disaster? That's just my take on it. We're not adding this to the portfolio anytime soon, at least not while I'm around. So anyway, go ahead and say what you got to say.
So he's picking one fund, and this is an ETF. This particular one, it's called the Seven Handle Index. It's a strategy shares ETF. But the lessons on this are powerful. We're in a low interest rate environment, as you know, all listeners know that. So when you see something generally that's paying an outsized yield, you have to stop and ask why. This particular fund, like you mentioned, Tom, there is leverage inside the fund, but there's also trading going on inside the fund. So the fund is basically a fund of funds. So it owns other ETFs inside of it. And what they're doing, there's leverage, and then they're trading these funds inside of it. So the distribution, although it is a 7% yield, quote unquote, where is that money coming from?
Capital gains.
Yeah, the actual yield on it is right about 3%, but with the capital gains and the leverage, that's how they're goosing that up to a 7% payout. So you look at this. Let's look at it from a portfolio standpoint. People that do a spend down plan on their retirement assets, it's kind of the same thing. If you think of it like, okay, I've got a checking account that's earning nothing right now, but you say it's a $100,000 checking account, you're taking $7,000 out, it's a 7% yield, but you're making point nothing on it. Is that a 7% yield? No, it's a reduction in your principal. Similar situation can happen with this.
Or it happens in the case of annuities also.
Exactly. There, it's a return of your own money. So it's not actually earning that. So with this particular fund, let's say you get in a protracted downturn in the market. Well, that leverage starts working against you.
Right.
And you're not able to trade, and so the yield plummets. Or if it pays out that yield, say it still keeps distributing it, what it's doing is just distributing, as you said, Tom, your seed corn.
When did I say that?
Many times. So it's you can look at it, you know, in isolation, but the lessons on this are powerful, you know, when you expand that concept to think of it from your portfolio standpoint. You know, when you're taking distributions, you know, your income from that should come from multiple sources, because you diversify, you know, into different assets, sectors, companies. You should also have a diversified income stream. You should have different layers in your portfolio. You know, and you have to be careful not to reach for yield in this kind of an environment, because it's a recipe for something bad to happen.
To your point, when you look at what just interest rates are on government bonds, and then you look at other types of yield, like this yield stated here, the difference is what's called a risk premium. So to put that in perspective, you used annuities or, you know, other insurance companies. So they have what are called risk premiums of sorts. So if you look at, if you're insuring a car and that person happens to travel to work at 3 a.m. in the middle of deer country, well, they have a high risk adjusted premium that they would need to pay from a data analytics perspective. Same principle here, but in reverse, where you're taking on the investment and the set of risks that you're taking on are what determines the extra yield required for you to take on those risks. So when you have such a large spread there, you're in essence, you should know in your mind, okay, there are embedded risks that I'm taking on to create this excess premium. You know, we talk about annuities. If you're getting a 7% payout from an annuity, well, they've baked in that's either a 10-year certain annuity or something like that, you know, where they're baking in that they're planning on you to die a lot sooner than normal for you to get something like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, life insurance, you know, annuities, all that, you know, it's all baked into it. But with the investments, I mean, you have to be careful. We own some things in the portfolio that have an outsized yield. And we're aware of what those risks are, where the risks are associated. You know, is it leverage? Is it just a sector that's out of favor? But on something like this, and this is where you have to be real careful of buying a product. You know, this is, if we were coming to you and saying, well, we got this fund that's paying 7%, you know, it's a sales job. You know, where is that coming from? You know,
well, what that means when you buy an investment product is I don't have to do any research. I don't want to do any research because, number one, I don't know how, and number two, I don't want to learn. I'm going to buy your investment product. Now, it's not always a bad thing, but do your research about the product.
Right.
And if it's a mutual fund, understand who the manager is. If it's an annuity, you want to know about the investment, the costs of doing it. There's nothing that's always a bad deal. Some things are an okay deal at times. But you need to know why you're doing the deal. One of the things that we try to do is explain to you why we're doing what we're doing. You may not agree with it. You may not even understand it. There comes a point where you have to trust the character and methodology employed by whoever it is managing your money, even if it's you. And I've questioned my own methodology in managing money many, many times, and I continue to, because you have to. You have to look at why is this being done, how, and how often is it being reviewed? How often is it being looked at?
It's one of the best things. I mean, when a security, whether it be a mutual fund or an individual stock, they have what's called a prospectus, or for an individual stock, a 10K that they produce annually. One of the things you talk about doing your research, I don't know why, but I immediately thought, because we're talking about adding on excess risks when you add on, you know, these outsized yield. I think about when you're watching, you know, a commercial and it was like, hey, we've got this new medicine to cure headaches. May cause swelling of the eyes and
headaches.
Yeah, loss of toes or something like that. You know, there is a section in each one of these things that it's specified to risks, where a company is required to state what they deem as certain risks to a company. You know, I think from a research perspective, that is one of the best things to look at. One of the easiest things to look at too, or, you know, okay, what, how can this get hurt? And it's very, very early on into the big document. You know, it's easy to find. You know, I think that from that perspective, if I was telling someone to, you know, to start building a research acumen, that's step one.
Well, and that's with, you know, funds and individual companies. You know, you look at, you know, or a REIT, you know, you look in their 10K, 10Q, and it's going to have, you know, a whole chapter on risks. And like you said, that is a good, you can understand a business when you look at the risks. It's a good way to back into what they do. You're learning it in reverse almost, but it's a really good way to understand a business.
Exactly. And Adarsh has said this to me before, and it sticks, is that you look at the risks and you look at when he's doing his research. This is something he taught me, was that I try to imagine what's the worst possible thing that can happen, and does it kill me? that's a fair assessment if you're doing something from a research perspective. You look at the list of risks and you go, well, that would suck, but, you know, you're not going bankrupt. And then you just kind of go down through the list, and, you know, you can build a big amount of acumen around a company just by doing that.
Well, let's take it back to the portfolio on a withdrawal plan. Let's say, and we've had this discussion with prospects and clients, you know, they say, well, you know, could I take a 7% withdrawal? And that's where the discussion starts, because you have to understand, and we do it this way. We say, here are what the risks of doing that are. You know, you look at a fund like this. Well, the risk is that you have a down market and it's liquidating its principal, and it's a downward spiral. It's no different with a portfolio. You know, if you're taking a 7% withdrawal rate because you're assuming that the market's going to return 8 or 9 to 10%, like it has recently, well, if it's just a flat market, or, you know, a slightly down market, not even a massive drop in the market, well, that's when you're getting into no man's land. You can't return from that. And so it's important to understand. And it's
I think you need to. All right, let's talk about what happens mathematically. So I had a guy come in like right after we started the firm, probably in 04, maybe 05. It's probably 04. He said, I had this account. I retired from UK. It was over $1 million. And I had been getting 13% a year for 15 years. So he says, I'm going to extrapolate that. So I'm going to take out 10% a year. And he thinks he's going to keep getting 13. Well, what had happened is 01 and 02 had happened. And his million had turned into about $600,000, but he's still taking 10% of the original million one $110,000 a year. Now it's coming off of not $1,000,001, but $600,000. He was very perilously close to getting his portfolio in a spot that it couldn't recover from. He was very puzzled. He was belligerent. He was unhappy. And I'm not sure what could have been done to have avoided that, given the pressure that he was putting the portfolio under and the financial amount that he wanted to get from it without working or doing anything else. But it began to really tax the portfolio, not just when the market went down, but when during that downturn he kept taking withdrawals as if the portfolio was still worth over $1,000,000, which it of course was not.
I think, you know, also when it comes to assessing risk, there are certain risks that can be quantified, but then there are certain risks which are just unknown, what you would call black swan events. So 1998, LTCM, long-term capital management, they did all their risk analysis, but the fund still failed because there were certain things that they just did not account for.
Was it five deltas?
Six sigma.
Yeah, I mean five sigmas. Six sigmas?
Yes.
So that's an event that is like every 1,000 years or something.
Yes, a very, very small probability. You know, and it actually happens, and that sort of derails even your risk assessment. So,
and the crazy thing is, those guys were the smartest people in the business,
right?
Nobel
right.
Prize winner type guys,
right? So it's always important to also have a plan B, perhaps be more diversified than just putting everything into one thing, because anything can happen.
And it's. The construction of the portfolio too, having more. So if you start off more conservative, let's say you're starting off with a 3% withdrawal rate, because when you retire, the biggest risk is that you have in the first 5 years a flat or slightly negative return, because then your portfolio has taken that initial hit right out of the gate, and it's really hard to catch up. And so in our experience, we've seen it. If you start off more conservative from a withdrawal rate, your chances of success are much higher. And what we love to see is when we can actually give our clients a raise, so to speak, because the principal is growing. Because
a big drop early is way more damaging than a big drop late.
Right. And that's what you're trying to mitigate. Through the investment research, through the allocation, through the withdrawal rate, every one of these concepts that we talk about, they're all tied together. They all work hand in hand. So it's really important. I mean, this is the ABCs, the oxygen, of investing. This is how you kind of form the whole thing, and that's why we talk about it all the time.
And so because we're small, we can be
nimble.
Right. And build you a portfolio that's
robust.
You passed the test.
But it's concepts like that. It's the fundamentals. It's like in sports, taking it back to the basics, learning the fundamentals of it. And it's so important to always bring it back to that. Right. And that's what we try to teach our clients over time. And then we can get in the weeds too. And some clients really like to get in the weeds.
So we're always bringing it back to sports, eh?
Yeah, got to.
How is being in the weeds connected to sports? I missed that one.
Yeah, bringing it back to sports.
I was thinking about the weeds. Well, you passed your quiz for today, Mike, so you're dismissed. You've been listening to the Tom Dupree Show with the Darsh Meshru, Philip Sexton, Mike Johnson, and, of course, Tom Dupree. Our goal is to educate, guide, and empower. We hope you learned something in the first half of the hour. We'll be back with more in the second half of the hour. And don't forget, in our first hour, we talked to Mercy Chefs, mercychefs.com, if you'd like to support and help the victims in Western Kentucky. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more in the second half of the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Dupree Show for the second half of the second hour. Joining us, Adarsh Meshru, Philip Sexton, Mike Johnson, and our host, Tom Dupree.
So this is by Harry Nilsson. And Harry Nilsson was a remarkable talent, songwriter, excellent, good performer, real good friends with John Lennon of the Beatles. They used to do a lot of drinking together and got kicked out of some places. And like John, he didn't make it past, I don't know, it's probably his 40s. But
all that drinking, maybe why he's talking about being late everywhere.
He was a hellraiser, a very talented one. Okay, millennials are supercharging the housing market. So the generation that supposedly didn't want to buy things now accounts for over half of all home purchase loan apps. Economists expect them to bolster demand for years. So one of the things that I've noticed about housing, okay, I just was the other day in the Atlanta area. And rather than just shoot through and stop at the OK Cafe and get my little thing right there next to the interstate, I got off and drove. I got on I-20 headed towards, headed east and kind of in downtown and then turned north towards a place called Druid Hills, and there's this little area down in there called Reynoldstown, which I think was an area of migrant workers at one time. So today, they have built lots of lofts, and I mean a whole bunch of them. Same thing's going on in Nashville. I've been to Indianapolis some lately. That is not so much a lofty kind of town. It's more houses, in places like Carmel, Indiana, and other places. And it's maybe not growing as much. My impression was that Atlanta had sort of hit the brakes on the growth, but I don't think that's the case. So if you're talking about, these units, my guess would be that millennials are buying more loft and condo type units as opposed to actual houses with a yard that has to be mowed. This article may or may not contradict me, but I was amazed. I'm amazed at how in, say, Nashville, they're building these things on every square acre that's available, that's in an area where they can do it. And it appears to be that way in Atlanta. And you would see a house that was almost falling down, had graffiti all over it, and then right next to it, a house that somebody's put $1 million into. So it's like there's no delineation between the good part of town and the not so good part of town. It's all kind of all mixed up in together. And anything that can be developed is being developed regardless of the surroundings, almost. People just live wherever the heck they want to live. And the money goes there, which, you know, must be the way things are these days. So anyway.
Yeah, I think it depends on the area that you live. Is from COVID, you are seeing more millennials that were living in lofts or apartments or townhomes moving more to the, if you want to call it, the suburbs, where they have more square footage, more yard. That trend started last year, and it looks like it's continuing. So millennials were born between 1981 and 1996. I'm R1. But millennials, you've gone through the,
You weren't born, you don't have a birthday. It only happens once every 4 years.
That's right. That's right.
So in technically you weren't born.
I guess so.
Kid you. He was born on leap day of 1984, February 29th. So in a sense, 3 years out of four, he doesn't really get
a
birth.
I'm not really here.
He doesn't get a birth.
He doesn't age.
Yeah. He's only 8 years old, so.
Curious case of Mike Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you think of the coming out of college, the millennials have gone through the Great Recession. They've gone through, they've lived in low interest rate environments. And one of the ideas was that, millennials aren't buying houses, so their overall net worth, they're not building equity. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Because you think of the prior generation, they bought a house in an interest rate environment that interest rates were declining. So the value of the house, by inflation, by interest rates, all these things, the value of the house was going up, building equity. A millennial that's buying a house today at these elevated prices because interest rates are low, they're talking about the balance sheet, the cash flow that it costs to service the debt, that's actually more attractive now than it was 30 years ago. But the question I have is how much equity will be actually built owning that house, because you're buying it at these elevated levels because interest rates are low. And, I hope it doesn't happen this way, but, it might be another case where bad timing, bad timing coming out of college, bad timing buying a house. You see it with investments. You get the timing wrong on one move, and it's hard to right the ship. It's kind of like this. Timing has not been good for millennials. If you do have interest rates go up, doesn't necessarily mean housing prices would go down, but they might not increase at the same rate. So, the old idea of building your net worth through building some equity in your home, it may not play out like it has in the past. It's not, everything doesn't always work the same as it has in the past. And that's why, you can't count on pensions. All these things that were in the past, millennials don't have. And so they're being forced, and this is where it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because they're being forced to sort of think outside the box on some of these things, how to build net worth. A lot of millennials are very entrepreneurial. They're starting new businesses, new ways of doing things, and technology incorporating that. What are you smiling at me for?
I don't know why. I just keep thinking of Rafiki off of The Lion King. The past is in the past. Sorry. But no, what I mean, one thing that I've just kind of set back and noticed, though, and being a millennial and comparing to the way things were to prior generations, I feel like millennials are following the same suit, just late to the party with everything. So when you think of like a baby boomer, the average baby boomer, so we're not going to use Tom Dupree here, for example.
Why not?
But, well, the average baby, you'll get it here in a second. The average baby boomer started having children early 20s, typically, you know? And so.
Yeah, that's true.
When you look at millennials, a lot of millennials are pushing, you know, family starting out to late 20s, even early 30s.
Or mid-30s.
Yeah, a lot of time.
I had my first child at 39 and a half.
That's why I said we were going to exclude you from.
Yeah, you do exclude me because I'm late to the game.
But when you think of that, you know, so that is why you're starting to see this millennial generation slowly start to creep into the housing market, because for the longest time it was this, you know, we're going to focus on other things, but now – you know, getting right back into that circle of starting a family, building a retirement portfolio, you know, building a career, things of that nature, that's starting to really take hold. You know, and to your point, Mike, eventually there will be enough pressure that inflation in housing does start to slow down. You know, but when you look at millennials, you know, from a economic standpoint, one of the biggest generation right now, you know, if they start to really start families at a faster rate 20 years from now, you know, where do we sit?
Mm-hmm. So if you look at all the things in society that are crumbling and not doing well, many institutions in society, it's sort of a brave new world. And what the market needs to be able to produce for people are houses that are affordable but nice. And it's beginning to do that. You're even beginning to see some of these things around Lexington. Basically, people want a place to crash and to have, you know, this or that. The idea of really big, nice houses, yeah, there's still people that buy those. But even if you're super wealthy, you get an 8,000-foot house, you probably live in about 400 square feet of it. So the rest of it is, in my opinion, kind of wasted. We need a car that's just mechanical. That's just the engine, you know, maybe even a standard shift, maybe a vinyl floor, something that's just, you know, that you can get wet, that doesn't have a rug on it, doesn't have all this stuff, things that are very basic. People are looking for things. Problem is, there are so many regulations surrounding. We've allowed the government class to get so large and to sap such a large piece of our economy with rent seeking and people having to insert themselves into the processes of business and the economy in a non-productive way. We're not able to deliver for millennials and people like that the kind of things that they should be able to have, because it's the process has gotten too monkeyed up. And, you know, it's gotten to be kind of a bad deal. And so I think that it's a tougher deal nowadays than it's ever been. And it's a brave new world. People have to approach it with courage, tenacity, vigor, go at it hard, and you don't know where it's going. And you know, this idea, you know, we take care of a lot of people who think they're supposed to be retiring at age 65. Well, that's not me, you know. You guys might wish that were the case, but, you know, it's – it's just it's a brave new world. Everything's different now.
Yeah, and you know, to that point, you talk about people retiring at 65. You know, I fully expect from the millennial generation that number to get pushed out even farther. Like I said, you know, that generation just seems to be, you know, 5 and 6 years behind on when they decide to do things. So, I mean, it very well could be that 30, 40 years from now, you know, you're still seeing a vast majority of that generation working, and, you know, and pushing things out to, you know, that 70, 75 range.
Well, you know what? You're even seeing it today because people quit and they, you know, then they realize they made a mistake and that they're bored or what have you.
Yeah.
And they want to go back to work.
That's what I would say. That's a big proponent of the increase in life expectancy, the increase in retirement age. You know, it's like you said, you get bored and, you know, you go back to work and, heck, you probably just added 6 years to your life at that point.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? But you do.
So, you know, one of the reasons, I guess, you know, millennials as a cohort are very important is because they today they number roughly 72 million people in the U.S., more than baby boomers. They crossed baby boomers in 2019. So their decisions, financial decisions, economic decisions are going to have ramifications for the entire economy. So they could be a significant tailwind. You know, their decisions could be a significant tailwind for what happens to the economy over the next decade and a half. What's also interesting is that millennials, even though they were late to start in the job market, some of them still perhaps don't make as much as they could. They, as a generation, will also inherit the most amount of wealth compared to any previous generation, because as baby boom, as the silent generation and then baby boomers, you know, pass, they will, you know, millennials will inherit that wealth. You know, if you go back to the decades of the 70s, the 80s, they were very good decades economically. And the reason for that was that baby boomers were at their peak earning and spending years. And this decade, the decade of the 20s and even the next decade will be decades when millennials are at their peak earning and spending years. So, you know, that is a big tailwind to both the market and the economy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the earliest piece of the millennials are just now getting close to that peak earning year age. And so you're not really seeing the effects yet on the spending, because millennials, they've done more with less, really, in terms of consumption. You know, most of the millennials, they'll have student debt. They have, you know, these various things, you know, from kind of legacy debts, if you will. So from a consumption standpoint, they've not been the major factor yet. But once, you know, they get into those peak earning years, once they start inheriting these assets, it's going to be, it could be very good for the economy.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we are at a point where interest rates are low, but in the 70s, when baby boomers were starting to buy homes, they also went through a period where they started buying homes, but interest rates rose, and then they peaked in the early 80s. So maybe something similar could happen where we have a few rocky years, but, you know, ultimately because of technology and various factors, you know, interest rates, you know, may not stay high or may stay low for even longer.
Right. But one of the things we've talked about with, you know, people that are coming in, especially, you know, millennials, where they're kind of trying to play catch up on the savings end of it. You know, they're trying to put back for retirement or for, you know, life, you know, later life. I think I like that better, later life instead of just retirement. But, you know, the old adage of compounding, you know, it's better to start when you're 22 than 32. Well, they haven't, because they couldn't for one reason or another. And now they're kind of trying to play catch up. And, you know, that's kind of plays into the stock market too, where you're seeing, you know, these meme stocks that we've talked about in the past. And, you know, you're seeing the effects of that lately, you know, how some of these things have gone down 60%, from their peak. You know, you have to be careful of playing catch up. So don't try to, you know, make up for those 10 lost years by taking on a lot of extra risk. You know, just be diligent and be disciplined and, you know, put back whatever you can.
I think one thing that people don't realize when they retire is that you have now gone from being in the business that you were in to the investment business. You are now, like it or not, an investment professional. Even if you hire a professional to manage your investments for you, you're in the investment business. And I don't think a lot of people have really embraced that or even realize it.
And I think I said it in the first hour when we were talking about medicine, you've always got to be your own best advocate. Whether that's researching who you want your financial advisor to be, or who your doctor. You've always got to look out for your own best interest. That's a wrap for this week of the Tom Dupree Show. We hope you've learned something. As I mentioned in the first hour, we had Mercy Chefs join us. Please donate to them if you have the desire to help the people in Western Kentucky. MercyChefs.com, or they have a Facebook page, Mercy Chefs. We appreciate you listening. If you'd like to talk to Tom, you can call him at 859-233-0400. His email address for feedback about the show, tdupree@dupreefinancial.com. We'd love to have more feedback. We had a good result last week, and we'd like to keep it up this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Got a big day, sorry.